A federal judge wants more information from the Trump administration today as he tries to figure out if it ignored his order to turn around planes of migrants sent to El Salvador. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Anti-government protesters in Tel Aviv insist the resumption of war will not bring Israeli hostages home alive. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. And we go inside the Gaza Strip where Palestinians are being forced to flee bombings again. Regulators say bridges across the country should be checked after last year's collapse in Baltimore. It's Friday, March 21st. On this day in 1952, Tiny Grimes and the Rocking Highlanders and Paul Williams and his Hucklebuckers got top billing in Cleveland, considered to be the first rock and roll concert. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge in Maryland has blocked Elon Musk's Doge entity from accessing personal data stored at the Social Security Administration. The judge also ruled Doge must delete any personally identifiable information gathered so far. NPR's Ashley Lopez has more.
In her ruling, Judge Ellen Lipton Hollander wrote that Musk's team has essentially been engaged in what she called a fishing expedition at the Social Security Administration. And this expedition, she wrote, has been based on little more than suspicion of fraud. The judge also noted that the agency gave members of Musk's team, quote, unbridled access to the personal and private data of millions of Americans. That includes Social Security numbers, medical records, and bank and credit card information. And while the court has now limited Doge's access to much of that information, it does say that the agency is still allowed to hand over data that adheres to federal privacy laws. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
A federal judge will try again today to get answers from the Justice Department about the deportation flights of migrants last weekend. The agency has not been forthcoming. President Trump has called for the impeachment of U.S. District Court Judge James Boasberg. The judge wants to know if the government has violated his orders. President Trump's executive action to dismantle the U.S. Education Department could lead to less oversight of states and schools. The Gulf States Newsroom's Stephen Bisaha reports that is causing concern in Alabama.
Trump signed the order about an hour before Democratic Congresswoman Terry Sewell spoke at a panel in Utah, Alabama. She got applause when she said she'd do all she could to push back.
Not only am I a proud product of the Black Belt, but I am a proud product of public schools in the Black Belt.
That region in Alabama is known for its rich soil, high poverty, and history of slavery. Greene County Superintendent Corey Jones also worries about federal oversight going away.
By taking that federal umbrella away and putting those funds in the state hands, we assume that our governor is going to do the right thing. But there's no guarantee.
Jones said more than 40% of the district's funds come from the federal government. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Utah, Alabama.
President Trump has invoked emergency powers to boost the production of critical minerals in the U.S. These are used in many electronic devices, and they're a key component in electric vehicles. Trump also says he will soon sign an agreement with Ukraine on its rare earth minerals.
We're doing very well with regard to Ukraine and Russia. And one of the things we are doing is signing a deal very shortly with respect to rare earths with Ukraine, which they have a tremendous value in rare earth, and we appreciate that.
Meanwhile, Ukraine and Russia have agreed in principle to a limited ceasefire, but it's not clear when that might take effect. This is NPR. The federal government says that Maryland authorities failed to conduct critical tests on the Francis Scott Key Bridge before it collapsed last year. It was struck by a ship. The National Transportation Safety Board is warning that other U.S. bridges need to be checked for vulnerability. From member station WYPR, Scott Massioni has more.
The National Transportation Safety Board's top official says the Maryland Transportation Authority failed to follow standards in assessing vulnerabilities to the Francis Scott Key Bridge. The board ran its own calculations and says when a cargo ship hit it last March, the bridge's risk of collapse was far higher than what is acceptable. NTSB Chair Jennifer Homedy says the state missed an opportunity to avert disaster.
The MDTA would have been able to proactively identify strategies to reduce the risk of a collapse and loss of lives associated with a vessel collision with the bridge.
The NTSB says the Chesapeake Bay Bridge has never been evaluated and has identified 68 other U.S. bridges across the nation that need assessment. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni.
Officials with Sudan's army say they have recaptured the presidential palace in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. It's been controlled for the past 2 years by the rival rebel group, the Rapid Support Forces, or the RSF. The Sudanese civil war has killed thousands of people and displaced millions of citizens. The lights are out at London's Heathrow Airport. It's closed for the day. Flights for hundreds of thousands of passengers have been disrupted. The power was cut to Heathrow Airport after a nearby substation caught fire. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The combination of engineering skill and a love for high-fidelity sound merged in one person in the late 1960s to put Minnesota on the map of high-end audio products. Jim Winey was a production engineer at 3M who spent his time after hours perfecting a unique kind of stereo speaker. He pioneered the technology to build a speaker that looks nothing like the kind of equipment that ends up in most people's living rooms. There are no speaker cones or wooden boxes to deliver sound. Instead, MagnaPan speakers are 6 feet tall and barely 2 inches thick. MagnaPan's marketing manager, Wendell Diller, sits in a pitch-black room in the company's White Bear Lake headquarters, listening to a group of speakers. He says the darkness enhances the listening experience and helps developers test new components. Diller says MagnaPan's approach stems from Winey's vision to exploit technology.
Jim was an Iowa farm boy. He's frugal, practical, had to be. And these products are an extension of where he came from.
Since its founding more than 40 years ago, the company manufactures the speakers at their White Bear Lake facility.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. In a few minutes, we hear from an Israeli hostage negotiator about the reaction inside Israel to the end of the ceasefire in Gaza. But first,
at a hearing today, U.S. District Judge James Boasberg will try to get answers from the Department of Justice about Venezuelan migrants deported to El Salvador.
President Trump has called for Boasberg to be impeached after he stopped the Trump administration from using the Alien Enemies Act to immediately deport the Venezuelans suspected of being members of the Tren de Aragua gang. But planes still left the U.S., carrying over 200 people to El Salvador. Now the judge wants the government to prove that they did not ignore his order.
NPR's immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo has been following all this and joins me now. Hi, Jimena.
Good morning.
Jimena, let's just take a step back here and break down why there's been such a reaction to Trump using this power to deport these men.
Well, Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act, and this is a presidential power that has only been previously used during times of war.
Right.
It allows the government to deport people without going through the regular immigration process, which can take years. Now, two groups, the ACLU and Democracy Forward, caught wind that he was going to do this and preemptively sued last weekend. They argued that the administration should not use the act to deport five Venezuelan men that they represent. They later broadened their request to apply to anyone potentially covered by the Alien Enemies Act under Trump's invocation. The judge agreed to pause deportation under the act for 2 weeks. But while this was all playing out in court, three planes left the U.S. carrying over 100 people the White House says were deported under the act. The Trump administration is alleging that these members are Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang. But in court filings earlier this week, immigration officials also said that many of those removed under the act do not have criminal records in the United States. And as noted, they were taken to El Salvador.
Okay, so the judge tried to stop these deportations or pause them for 2 weeks. There were some new filings in the case yesterday. What did they show?
Yesterday, the DOJ had to file additional details about the flights, but Boasberg says that they, quote, again evaded its obligations. He said that Trump's cabinet secretaries are deciding whether to refuse to provide evidence. The executive branch has the power to not give judges information they want if officials say it will harm national security or foreign relations. But Boasberg says the government filings are, quote, woefully insufficient because they're still deliberating whether to invoke this so-called state secrets privilege.
And what does Boasberg want the government to do now? What are the next steps?
He's asking the government today to explain any of its discussions about invoking this privilege of state secrets, and they must make a final decision by March 25th. A Justice Department spokesperson said the department sees the questions from Boasberg as, quote, inappropriate judicial overreach. And more of this might be discussed in a hearing this afternoon.
Now, this is one case of many around President Trump's actions. Just zoom out a little bit. What has this week shown us about the legal challenges the Trump administration is facing?
This case is not the only one that has attracted strong words from judges. And ultimately, the Trump administration is using laws that have not been tested for decades and stretching that executive power. Many of those questions are ending up in courts across the country, including with results that may not favor Trump's interpretation. We can expect more of these challenges to work their way up the judicial system and even end up in the Supreme Court.
All right. Thanks, Ximena.
Thank you.
NPR's Ximena Bustillo.
Israeli airstrikes killed more than 500 people in Gaza and wounded 900 others this week, according to Gaza's health ministry. Israel says it's targeting Hamas. The bombs have also struck homes, particularly in the north of the tiny coastal strip. That is where NPR's producer, Anas Baba, went to see the impact. He shared his reporting with NPR correspondent Eva Traoui in Dubai. And a warning, this report contains graphic descriptions of war some might find disturbing.
A temporary ceasefire had been holding for 2 months, with many Palestinians in Gaza believing war was over. But war is back, and people are on the move again. It's windy and cold. Parents and their kids, many of them barefoot, are heeding Israeli evacuation orders and fleeing damaged homes they'd only just returned to in the ceasefire. They walk on dirt roads past neighborhoods of rubble, dragging gas canisters, blankets, and empty water jugs. And once again, the wailing grief of mothers fills Gaza's hospitals. At the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza, tiny white shrouds are stacked atop larger ones. These are the lifeless infants who will be buried with their parents, killed in overnight attacks. Gaza's health ministry says 200 children have been killed since the first blitz of Israeli airstrikes Tuesday. Umma Muhammad Abu Nasser watches as doctors tend to her 5-year-old son after an Israeli airstrike Thursday. Out of nowhere, we just found the house bombed, she says. We were asleep. My cousins, sister-in-law, all the kids. What did they do to deserve this, she says. Israel sent ground troops back to parts of Gaza. The military says it's striking Hamas infrastructure and that it killed Hamas officials in its attacks this week that shattered the tenuous ceasefire. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, backed by a far-right coalition, says the offensive was launched to complete the war's aims of freeing Israeli hostages held in Gaza and destroying Hamas, the group that attacked Israel in 2023. The White House says it supports the return to war, but in Israel... thousands have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in recent days to protest the decision, saying it endangers the lives of hostages. In Gaza, hospitals are strained and families shattered. Israel continues to block the entry of medical supplies, food, fuel, and all goods into Gaza, warning that what comes next will be harsher than anything Gaza has already seen. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with Anas Baba in Gaza.
To get more of a sense of that reaction inside Israel, we're joined by Gershon Baskin. He's a veteran hostage negotiator and Israeli peace activist. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So what's the Israeli public's reaction been to the government resuming the war in Gaza?
Well, what we've seen is that the majority of Israelis, between 65 to 80% of Israelis, want this war to end and want the hostages to be brought home. And much of the public believes that the continuation or the renewal of the war is putting the hostages' lives in danger, and don't believe that the release of the hostages can be achieved through military means. I would say that a good half of Israeli society, if not more, believe that there is no military solution for dealing with Hamas, and there must be a political solution. And even though we've seen support for Prime Minister Netanyahu increasing in the polls in the last couple of months, he still doesn't get enough support if we were to have elections to form a new coalition. So now, he is actually acting against the will of the majority of Israelis right now.
Now, the prime minister would say, actually, this is the way, right? He said, from now on, negotiations will only be led under fire. As a hostage negotiator, a successful one who negotiated the release of Israeli soldier Galit Shalit back in 2011, is negotiating while attacks continue an effective strategy?
I don't think so. I think that with the situation that Hamas is in, without the lack of the political leadership of Hamas in Gaza, only military leaders of Hamas are left in Gaza today, and they are not necessarily taking orders from the Hamas leadership outside. We're putting the hostages in direct danger. They have threatened to execute them. They could be killed by Israeli bombing in Gaza. We know that hostages have been killed by Israeli bombing since the beginning of the war. There is no evidence whatsoever that the military pressure that Netanyahu talks about would actually achieve any of the goals that he's put for Israel in this war, either the elimination of Hamas or the return of the hostages. Quite the opposite.
And so far what we've seen is hostages have been released in exchange deals. Right now, Hamas is believed to be holding more than 20 hostages who are still alive. That doesn't include those who are believed to be dead. And Israel and the U.S. blame Hamas for the breakdown of the ceasefire, even though Israel broke it, because they are still holding the hostages. Does Hamas bear responsibility here for this?
Well, there were Hamas breaches during the ceasefire, but the main point is that Hamas compromised in entering into the first stage of the ceasefire because they were assured by the mediators, Qatar and Egypt, who apparently received assurance from the United States that phase two of the hostage deal would lead to an end to the war and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. This was the understanding of everyone who went into this deal that Mr. Witkoff enabled to happen. And in fact, Israel had committed itself to begin talks on phase two by day 16 of the first 42 days period and conclude those talks by day 30. That never happened. And apparently Netanyahu and Israel never had any intention of moving into phase two. So I think it's improper, it's inaccurate to put all the responsibility on Israel for the renewal of the... for the renewal of the war. And not ending this war and bringing the hostages home. Hamas has said repeatedly that they're willing to release all the hostages. There are 59 in total, including those who are alive. And they have said they're willing to do it in one or two tranches. But yet Israel has refused to agree to the terms which would end the war and bring about an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza.
And what are the hostage families saying in this moment about their loved ones? And what they
want. The majority of the hostage families are panicking. They had hoped that their loved ones would be able to come home. They've gone through horrible tortures. We've heard the stories of the returning hostages who have told very vivid accounts of the horrors that they went through during the 500 plus days that they were in captivity. And of course, every single hostage family is very, very concerned that they may never see their loved ones again.
That's longtime Israeli hostage negotiator and peace activist Gershon Baskin. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
For news, updates, and differing views of the conflict, you can visit npr.org/Mideast Updates. This is NPR News.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. When you turn on the faucet to take a shower, you just want the water to be warm. You don't want to think about what kind of energy was used to heat it, but utilities do. As electric heat pump water heaters gain popularity, some utilities in the West are testing technology that can adjust the time these devices use electricity to when there's more clean energy on the grid.
Heat pump water heaters are really easy to control.
Wesley Whited is with DNV, a global consulting firm. He says this can be done while still maintaining residents' comfort.
Residents have really predictable hot water use patterns. So think about your morning routine. We're using a lot of hot water in the morning as we're getting our families ready for school and ready for work. But we're not having a lot of high hot water demand, say, at 1 p.m. And that is actually the time when we have a lot of excess renewable energy on the grid.
The approach can help consumers save money because they're shifting their energy use to times when it's more abundant and cheaper. And it can help the grid use more clean energy, which reduces carbon pollution. So Whited says he's excited about the technology.
From a climate perspective, heat pump water heater is really going to be a hero of the future energy transition.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The Justice Department is filing domestic terrorism charges against three people arrested in past weeks for violent attacks on Tesla cars, showrooms, and charging stations. Attorney General Pam Bondi has said the department would be aggressively going after whoever was behind the attacks. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has more on the situation and joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jacqueline, I thought there was no federal domestic terrorism charge. What are these charges?
So you're right on that. There is no domestic terrorism federal law to charge these folks with. But basically, across the country, attacks against Tesla cars and showrooms have been going on since January. And earlier this week, Attorney General Bondi came out pretty forcefully against these attacks, calling them domestic terrorism. She said that the department will be taking this kind of vandalism really seriously. So these charges are her making good on that promise.
Okay, so tell us more about the attacks. What exactly is the DOJ saying happened?
Yeah, these specific incidents happened back in January and February. The DOJ and investigators alleged that the three suspects threw Molotov cocktails, fired guns, and sprayed graffiti at Tesla locations in South Carolina, Colorado, and Oregon. The three people facing charges are Lucy Grace Nelson, Daniel Clark Pounder, and Adam Matthew Lansky. There's no evidence that they knew each other or coordinated their attacks. I spoke to Patrick Chisholm, the attorney of Daniel Clark Pounder, who's accused of attacking South Carolina Tesla charging stations.
I think that the government, by charging Mr. Clark Pounder with what they have, has shown how serious they're taking it and also shown that there are serious consequences for this type of behavior.
Okay, so you also spoke to some experts on domestic terrorism. What did they say about how the federal government is responding?
So this may surprise a lot of listeners, actually, but they said this was kind of expected. Bruce Hoffman, the senior fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations, had this to say.
Well, it's absolutely domestic terrorism. I know that may discomfort many people, but vandalism is a crime that, if it's committed with a political motive, can certainly be defined as terrorism.
And like we said earlier, it may be surprising to learn that the U.S. doesn't actually have a federal law on domestic terrorism. But like Huffman said, there are definitions investigators and prosecutors use when deciding when someone can be charged on it. They factor in the motive and their means of attack, like using a bomb or arson. And this is not new. In the 1990s, the FBI investigated acts of vandalism and arson committed by radical environmentalist groups as domestic terrorism.
Okay, so how does a case being categorized as domestic terrorism change things?
Basically, this means there'll be much stiffer penalties if the defendants are found guilty. And the folks I spoke to said that if it's determined that a crime is an act of terrorism, the punishment can become more severe.
Okay.
Attorney General Bondi said these three people are now facing federal charges and could face 5 to 20 years in prison if found guilty.
NPR correspondent Jacqueline Diaz. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
It's Friday, which means it's time for StoryCorps. Today, a conversation recorded inside a Brooklyn, New York funeral home. It's owned by Doris Amon, who's been in the business for nearly half a century. She spoke with her friend and fellow funeral director, Alexandra Mosca, about what's kept them at it for so long.
Well, when we were children, we never thought that we would go into this profession. It was the furthest thing from our minds.
We didn't bury Barbie dolls
in shoeboxes.
As some people may think, I was discouraged every step of the way. My first boss said to me, "Who will hire you? You're a woman."
We entered a man's business. You never see in a movie a funeral director that's a woman.
And there was a physical aspect to this, of course.
Absolutely. You would have to lug the casket and the body up a 3-story walk-up. But if they say it can't be done, I'll prove to you it can't be done.
Exactly. Which is one of the other things we have in common.
Oh, yeah.
Turning a no into a yes. Another one of the things that I believe you and I really share is to leave a family with an image of the person looking as they remember them looking.
It's called the closure moment, so that they don't remember that horrid scene
ICU. Yes.
And some of them have said to me they want a closed casket. And I said, "You take a peek and let me know."
Yes.
And they'll say, "How the heck did you pull this off?"
Yeah.
And my answer usually is, "I do my face every morning. I had a lot of practice." But when it comes to my own demise, do I want an open casket? I don't know. Do you want an open casket?
Well, now that's an interesting question because I advocate for open casket. But sometimes I think, well, I can see someone coming and go, "Eh, she looks okay. Hair's a little messy. Always was. I don't know." A lot of times people will say to me, "Aren't you jaded by now?" I said, "Never. You never get used to it."
How many times? I'll be shedding a tear going up
them.
The aisle.
That's right.
As soon as I hear the organ music,
absolutely,
that's it for me.
Yes.
And I don't have a problem hiding the tears. If I drop dead tomorrow,
God forbid, this
place is not going to be big enough.
For the people who are coming.
Yeah, because the thank yous that I get after the services makes me realize that it was my niche and I found it. And here we are today sitting in my funeral home, a building that I've owned for 36 years. Sometimes I see it from a distance and I just look and say, "That baby's mine. And I'm here until I close my eyes and they drag me up to the cemetery."
Doris Amon and Alexandra Mosca for StoryCorps in Brooklyn. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. And from Dignity Memorial, pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
A few years ago, the Belgian singer Tamino left his home country to settle in New York.
Leaving behind a place, a relationship, maybe even a belief system.
So he channeled that change and loss into a new album.
Tell me again that you miss me.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News. Maybe.
Tune in for All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXC. It's 529. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for tuning in on this Friday morning. It's March 21st. We may see some snow today, and that is the day after actual spring happening yesterday, and could be moving in tomorrow night. But it is spring, and that means sometimes the forecasts don't happen. Could be rain. Highs 30 to 41 across the region today, with evening lows from 5 to 13, which to me is sounding like sap is running out there. Mostly sunny on Saturday, highs in the mid-30s to low 40s, but rain and snow possible in the evening with lows in the mid-20s to low 30s. Could be some accumulation tomorrow night. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, you can contact us, 218-326-1234 during business hours. The board's full meeting schedule is available online at kaxe.org. With ice conditions changing rapidly, the Minnesota DNR is reminding us to use extreme caution on area lakes. With fluctuating temperatures and rain, ice can deteriorate quickly. You wear a life jacket is recommended. Use your ice picks. If you do go fishing, bring a buddy along with your white bucket that you might be sitting on the lake. And let us know how it's going out there. Lots of folks are reporting they're catching perch right now. We talked to Jeff Sundin yesterday about his trip going up to the Lake of the Woods. Text us at 218-326-1234. We have some live music around the region tonight. Paul Lawrence is at Smoke on the Water in Coleraine at 6. And Mark Joseph playing the music of Cat Stevens at the Ore House in Gilbert at 8 p.m. We receive support from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com. Here's John Latimer. It's our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, March 21st, in the years 2000, 2003, and 2006, the first dandelions were found in bloom. And all of these were found in roughly the same locations. That is to say, they are all blooming on the south side of a large brick building. In one case, in the year 2000, a friend of mine brought one in from the sunny southern lawn of the Grand Rapids Post Office, a large brick building. And this is a familiar sight to those of us who examine the grassy areas located just south of these kinds of places, because the building acts as a giant heat sink and it warms the earth near the base of the wall, and that heat is instrumental in helping the dandelions become among the first flowers of the spring.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Maryland failed to conduct crucial assessments of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, which could have prevented its collapse last year.
That's according to a new report by the National Transportation Safety Board on the collapse of the bridge following a collision with a cargo ship. And the board says there are other bridges at risk.
Scott Massioni from member station WIPR joins me to talk about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
So what could Maryland have done to better prepare itself for this kind of disaster?
Well, there's quite a few things that a certain industry standard says they could have done. Those industry standards were started in the early 1990s, and Maryland just really didn't conduct the assessments that they were supposed to in terms of what those industry standards set. That's according to the NTSB. They say that lack of oversight could have been a big factor in the collision. The NTSB also noted that it conducted its own survey and found the bridge was 30 times over that risk threshold that was set by those industry standards. And also, just as a reminder, a cargo ship named the Dolly rammed into the Key Bridge this time last year in March, causing its collapse and also the death of six people.
What sort of things do these assessments entail?
They look at things like vessel traffic, vessel transit speeds, loading characteristics, a lot of those sorts of attributes. And over the years, ships have gotten bigger and bigger, and the bridges have gotten older, which means they need to adapt by putting things up like dolphins, which are these sort of concrete barriers that keep ships from actually getting to the bridge and ramming into them. So these industry standards have asked these bridge owners to take these extra precautions to avoid collapse. NTSB Chair Jennifer Homedy noted how those changes in vessel sizes have really made the industry completely different and had bridges really have to look at what they're doing in terms of that sort of thing.
These bridge owners need to be looking at recent vessel traffic. Things have changed over time. Vessels have gotten bigger, heavier. At one point in the 1950s, we had vessels that had just 800 containers on them. Now we're talking 24,000 containers.
What about other bridges across the nation?
The NTSB noted that Maryland specifically hasn't conducted these assessments on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, which spans 17.6 miles. It's the fourth largest bridge in the United States, according to length. It also identified 68 other bridges across the country that weren't built to the needs and specifications of this company. NTSB is strongly urging those bridge owners right now to conduct assessments, to report back to the NTSB with remediation plans. And those bridges, they span from California to Washington to New York. They're all over the United States. So this is going to be quite an undertaking for people who own bridges and for different states and departments of transportation.
That's WIPR's Scott Massioni. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
For older adults who need daytime care or just want more opportunities to socialize, it can be hard to find programs that support them. Paying for care can be a challenge as well. Vermont Public's Nina Keck recently spoke with several people who rely on adult day services.
Project Independence is an adult day program in Middlebury, Vermont. And by 8:30 most weekday mornings, there's a steady stream of arrivals.
Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning.
Welcome. Welcome. How are you today? Yeah.
Clients range in age from 50 to 100, and many take advantage of the nonprofit's fleet of buses that provide door-to-door transportation. As they motor up, staff spring into action with walkers ready to help patrons inside.
Hi, Sam.
Hey.
Hey, morning.
Good morning to you.
Here, let's get your coat off, and then we can head into the restroom.
Okay. The program is housed in a cheerful, oversized farmhouse. Besides meals, there are discussion groups, games, and special activities, like this mid-morning jam session.
One, two, ready, play.
78-year-old Diane Whitney doesn't drive and says without this program, she'd be a shut-in.
I told him if I could rename this building, I would call it Open Arms
You can get a hug whenever you want one.
Caregivers also call this service a godsend. Roughly 22% of the U.S. workforce is caring for a family member, according to the most recent national survey of caregivers. 50-year-old Nikki Juvan is among them. Her husband has had multiple strokes and attends Project Independence 5 days a week.
It meant that I could go to work and continue to do my job, knowing that he was being taken care of, and also being engaged with other people.
Prices for adult day services vary by state. This program costs nearly $26 an hour, more if you take the bus. Medicare, the federal health insurance program for people 65 and older, doesn't cover it. Some people pay out of pocket or with long-term care insurance. But as of 2022, 79% of Americans who used adult day services relied on Medicaid. In Vermont, the program channels state and federal funds to low and moderate income adults. People like Nikki Juvan's husband and 80-year-old Maureen Waters.
Hello, Maureen.
Hi, I'm Maureen.
Hello. Can I get your coat?
Waters lives by herself and has problems with her memory. Coming to Project Independence was her family's idea. Now she can't imagine not.
Yes. You look around and you think, I'm not alone. And the people who come here are just so nice and friendly. And we're all here for the same reason. To have the support of the staff and each other, it isn't easy living alone.
But that support may be in jeopardy. Funding for Medicaid remains uncertain as Republican lawmakers try to balance spending with large tax cuts President Trump is calling for. Adult day program administrators in Vermont are worried. Maureen Waters, meanwhile, is better at living in the moment.
Oh, I love to sing. Of course, 12 years of Catholic school singing in the choir, and I can still remember hymns in Latin.
Her favorite is called Give Us Peace, something she says this place does.
Donat nobis pacem, pacem. Donat nobis pacem. My voice is better than that.
For NPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
This is NPR News.
Since 1976, KAXE has been people-powered radio, telling the stories of the people and the land of northern Minnesota. We are not media that is corporately owned. We are fueled by you. with local business support, volunteer-hosted programs, and members who keep our focus on what matters most, our community.
Scott, why do you support KXE?
I think that no matter what kind of program you guys do, how slick your production values get, whatever the thing does, you never lose sight of where it started and why it's there, and that's the community. And I think that's the way we hang in there with you.
You can keep people-powered radio going strong for Northern Minnesota. Text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. I've been on the airwaves for about 25 years at KAXE, and now more than ever, I can't thank you enough.
And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And Amy Martinez. There's a new leader at the International Olympic Committee. Christy Coventry is the first woman and first African to lead the group. She's a former Olympic swimmer and sports minister in the Zimbabwean government.
This is an extraordinary moment. As a 9-year-old girl, I never thought that I would be standing up here one day, getting to give back to this incredible movement of ours.
To hear more about the new IOC president, we're joined by Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg. So, Kate, before we get to the vote, what do we know about Christy Coventry?
Good morning, A. Well, Coventry and I actually have quite a bit in common. We were both born in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare, both in 1983. So that's just a funny aside. But yeah, she was born 3 years after the end of a bitter liberation war that saw the end of white minority rule in what had been Rhodesia. She attended an all-girls Catholic high school. And she was actually still a schoolgirl in 2000 when she became the first Zimbabwean swimmer ever to reach the Olympic semifinals. She went on to college in America at Auburn University in Alabama. Then, in the 2004-2008 Olympics, she won gold both times in the 200-meter backstroke. She retired from swimming in 2016 with 7 Olympic medals.
Kate, I thought you were going to say you were both gold medal Olympic swimmers at first. So how did she?
Our similarities don't go that far, unfortunately.
Yes. Now, how did she make her way from sports into politics?
Well, after she retired, Zimbabwe's then president, Robert Mugabe, hailed her, a white blonde athlete, as the country's golden girl. And she was popular across racial lines. Then, after Mugabe was deposed in a military coup after 37 years of rule in 2017, Coventry was made sports minister in the new government led by Mugabe's former right-hand man, President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Mnangagwa, who's known as the crocodile, has been accused of multiple human rights abuses, and Coventry has come under some criticism for staying in his government even after disputed elections in 2023.
Okay, how much competition did she face for the job?
Well, a lot, and all of it male. Coventry sits on the IOC's executive board, and she faced 6 men, all vying for the top job, including the IOC's Spanish vice president, who was the runner-up. In her speech after winning 49 of 97 votes, she said she was proud to have shattered a glass ceiling. She's not only the first female president in the IOC's 130-year history, she is also the first African, and at 41 years old, the youngest. And she's promised to make the sport a bridge between countries and cultures and promote opportunities for women in sports and the Olympic movement.
All right, so what is on her to-do list as she tackles this new job?
Well, she faces a bunch of challenges representing a global games in an increasingly polarized world. The next Summer Olympics, as you know, will be held in the United States in Los Angeles in 2028, towards the end of President Trump's second term. And Trump has waded into sports controversies, including opposing transgender women and girls in women's sports. But Trump might have a friend in Coventry on that issue. She has said that transgender women have a physical advantage and she backs restrictions based on biological sex. So Coventry is likely to have a busy 8-year term.
All right, that's Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Here at KAXC, we are excited to announce new programs coming to the airwaves in 2025, like Minnesota Mixtape, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. An hour-long spotlight of our local music scene, hosted by me, Malachi Coons. Minnesota Mixtape will continue KAXC's long tradition of uplifting local arts and will highlight the talents of Minnesota musicians by pairing the best new releases with familiar favorites from the past, alongside in-depth artist interviews and exclusive live sessions. Keep on the lookout for other exciting new shows on KAXC in the new year. Our new local music show is Minnesota Mixtape, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. on KAXE, made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Shill for charity as we wrap up our business stories from the vast Houston rodeo that ends on Sunday.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm David Brancaccio. First, the business of air travel is in a snarl today with the electricity out at London's Heathrow Airport, which is normally one of the five busiest in the world. This is affecting air travel worldwide. The BBC's Will Bain is following this for us.
It was some start to a Friday for thousands of passengers stranded after flights were cancelled or diverted to other British or sometimes European destinations. Some planes travelling from the United States, Canada, India and the Caribbean were forced to turn around in mid-air. Over 1,300 flights had been expected to land or depart from Heathrow on Friday. The airport says it remained shut until midnight. The root cause of the chaos was a fire in a nearby electrical substation which supplies Heathrow. And it's not yet known what caused that fire. The government's energy minister, Ed Miliband, said the incident made Heathrow look vulnerable. We've got to learn lessons, he said, about not just Heathrow, but how we protect our major infrastructure. In London, I'm the BBC's Will Bain for Marketplace.
Markets Dow, S&P and NASDAQ futures are all down in the 4 to 5/10% range now. The average 30-year fixed rate mortgage is at its lowest since the first week of December.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
A business reporter goes to Rodeo Houston, a colossal three-week event that wraps up this weekend. Yesterday, we heard from school-age Texans going for ribbons and trophies with their beautiful barrows, charming chickens, and stately steers. Now that the winners and losers are ranked in numerical order, the show animals are turned into cash as I get tricks of the trade at a junior livestock auction.
Now, howdy, y'all. Let's sell some lambs and goats. Lot one.
It's the Friday morning junior market auction at Rodeo Houston, where the students put their gorgeous goats and luxurious lambs up for sale to the highest bidder. On stage, the number two rated lamb, 173 pounds, medium wool.
His lamb's name is Trump.
It's the hot name these days, regardless of species. Here's the number two goat.
Goat's name is Trump.
Most people in the crowd here clutch a list of all 288 lots being auctioned here. Some also have a yardstick to wave to make a bid. As for me, I come equipped with a peer-reviewed journal, Volume 56 of Management Science, the article Charitable Motives and Bidding in Charity Auctions, to help me better understand just what I'm looking at.
Ladies and gentlemen, the sale's on. Diamond, how many dollars where? Could be 50,000.
In a normal auction, people want to pay the lowest prices for highest quality, but here, they're happy to pay way, way above the going rate for goats and lambs to generate a pile of philanthropic money for a scholarship fund here in Texas.
I believe the commitment for this year from the rodeo to the youth of Texas is $28 million.
Tracy Troop is chairman of this auction's committee, which raised $4.2 million in last year's sale. It's a process that turns lambs and goats into what is actually two pots of cash, the big one for the education fund and a smaller lump sum that goes to the animal's student owner. 40 grand for the owner of the grand champion lamb, 30 grand for the grand champion goat.
They can use it for college education. They can use it to go purchase another animal to show next year. So they can use it for any purpose that they decide to use it for. But the additional money that's raised goes to scholarships.
That $50,000 we heard earlier was the start of the bidding on the grand champion number one lamb raised by high school senior Madden Wise from Brownwood, Texas. Now, a normal wool lamb of this size would go at a commercial Texas auction for around $200 these days. But with charity as the incentive,
now 375, $375,000.
That journal article describes competing experiments that found that the higher the percentage to charity, the higher the bidding. Now that's in part because charity-minded bidders collude in a benevolent way to get the number higher. The authors, professors from Queensland University, Australia, and Rutgers in New Jersey, call people doing their charitable best to juice up the price unpaid shills. Now, out of respect for the public-spirited people here, let's call them philanthropic bidder-uppers. Again, Mr. Troop, the auction chair.
First of all, it creates a little competition, but it's amazing. Most of the people in that room are very good friends. You have the added touch of the kids being here, and who doesn't love to donate to a child?
People bidding in charity auctions are doing it all or in part for a higher purpose, which confounds some economists who like to think that humans just do things selfishly. Some theorize that people bid so they receive in return what researchers call the warm glow of doing good, or to get the benefits of signaling their good work to the wider community. The Journal of Management study has evidence that refutes that second part, showing little difference between anonymous bidding and bidding with your name attached. Maybe helping others is a reward in itself.
$450, $460, $450, $460. Any more? Y'all done. Thank you for the help. Thank you for the help. I sold it to you, $450,000.
Think about that. Madden's neatly shaved, pink-hued lamb named Tudato goes for more than the median price of a home in America.
So you give it up for Madden Wise, our grand champion lamb for 2025.
Money lessons abound here, like when Madden, bound for Oklahoma State University, gets asked the career question.
I'd like to get a degree in law and pursue overseas contracting.
Overseas contracting. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I just heard it's quick cash, so I can make this possible.
All of our Houston Rodeo tricks of the trade are now streamable at Marketplace Online, from the steamy retail of Western hats to the Carnival Midway gourmet wrestling with tariffs. In our videos, we also investigate who bears responsibility for putting Fruity Pebbles on deep-fried shrimp at the rodeo. Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, our handle is Marketplace APM. I'm David Brancaccio with our morning report. APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, it's news headlines from National Public Radio. You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Later this morning before 9 o'clock, we are meeting the fire chief in Grand Rapids. He helped save a woman's life last Sunday. We'll tell him more. He'll tell us more about it and give us some pointers on safety during fire season and any time in our homes. The Sustainable Sheep and Fiber Community of Northern Minnesota has a gathering today from 1 to 3 at the Clearwater Life Center in Gonvick. Learn some fiber art or share your latest projects. All are welcome. We also want to tell you what's going on KAXE today at 9 o'clock. It is Headwaters with your host, Malachi Coons. 10 o'clock,